going to get started, just a reminder, we're recording this call. So I'm Ellie Hassenfeld. I'm the co-founder of GiveWell. And there's two other GiveWell staff members on the call who may answer questions throughout. One is Tim Tilleen Lawton, and the other is Jake Marcus. So let me get started and go through our plan here. I'm going to give a very brief introduction to our recommendations and then open the floor up for questions. I'm planning to try to keep things relatively brief because we put a lot of material out there already, and I'd rather use this time to answer the questions that you have. We're recording this call so we can post it on our website, and if you prefer that anything you say be edited out, just send me an email after the call and we can do that. If you don't have my email, send an email to info@givewell.org. So to keep things organized, you're all on mute right now. And to ask questions, you should do a couple of things. You can log in to the Uber conference website at the link I emailed out earlier and put a note in the chat that you'd like to ask a question. You can also email info@givewell.org saying that you would like to ask a question. If you could give us your phone number when you do that, that'd be great, so I know to unmute you. You also can, if you could give us the topic of the question that you'd like to ask, that would be helpful too, so we can try and answer questions of similar topics more or less together. So what I want to do is first give a quick background on our process for choosing top charities, talk very briefly about the strengths and weaknesses of our top charities and other standouts, and then discuss our plans for finding new top charities next year, and then let you all ask the questions that you have on your mind. So broadly speaking, our process is that we first try to identify interventions that have strong evidence of effectiveness, often independent of the charitable organization itself. So this is often evidence that comes from academics who research global health and economic empowerment programs. And with that evidence base, we try to then, once we have a sense for the interventions that seem most promising, deeply vet those interventions to determine whether or not we think they're promising and how cost effective they are. Then we also go and try to identify charities that are working on those programs. And so what we end up with at the end of the year and what we've just published are intervention reports that assess the independent evidence for a program, and then also charity reviews, which assess the strengths and weaknesses of charities. And so what we are doing is using those interventions as the filter for the charities that we look at. You know, right now we're not out there trying to sort through all the charities that exist to find ones that seem promising independent of the interventions that they are implementing. Moving on to the strengths and weaknesses of our top charities, I think the best, simplest summary information for what we have is a table that's under the summary heading in the blog post that we put out on Monday announcing our new top charities. And it lays out for our four top charities how we see them comparing across various dimensions. One of the things that we found most challenging this year is that each of our top charities seems to stand out on one of the factors that we find most important when thinking about how to rank charities. And so I think that table is a good thing to go back to. I'll quickly run through some of the key points. The Deworm the World initiative, which assists governments in their deworming programs, by our relatively uncertain and rough and certainly subject to judgment cost-effectiveness estimates, its programming appears to be 10 to 20 times as cost-effective as cash transfers. And so that means it's 10 to 20 times cash transfers, 2 to 4 times or 1 to 4 times as cost-effective as another deworming program and AMF's BedNets program. And so it really stands out on that dimension. On the other hand, it appears to us that its room for more funding, meaning the amount that it can take in and use productively, is relatively limited. And so, you know, we are recommending donations to Deworm the World initiative, but that's the amount that we hope to move them is bounded by what we think they can use productively. And our total target for them this giving season is about $750,000. On the other side of the spectrum, there's an organization, GiveDirectly, which gives cash to very poor people in East Africa. And, you know, we believe that they have extremely high room for more funding. We think they could take in up to $40 million and use it productively. On the other hand, we, you know, again, based on those relatively uncertain, very rough cost-effectiveness estimates, we think they're the least cost-effective of the organizations on our list. They're also the organization that has stood out the most for its organizational characteristics, that it communicates very well with us, shares significant information, has outstanding monitoring of its programs, has a track record of doing so effectively. And so it's quite strong on those organizational characteristics. You know, then there's the Against Malaria Foundation. They, you know, they're somewhere in the middle. They're quite strong on organizational characteristics, but, you know, in our view, not quite as strong as GiveDirectly. They're more cost-effective in by our estimates than GiveDirectly, but less so than the Deworm the World initiative, and they have a good deal of room for more funding. We think approximately $5 million more right now, and perhaps even more if you're highly confident in the program that they're running. And then finally, there's the Schistosomiasis Control Initiative, or SCI. They're an organization that runs a very cost-effective program and has a pretty strong track record of rolling out the program, but it is the top charity of ours that we've had the most difficulty communicating with and still have some relatively substantial questions about how they use their funds and what impact additional funding would have. So, you know, those are our, and finally, in terms of the amount of money we think they can take in, we think they have a substantial amount of room for more funding, around $6.5 million. But based on the donations we already anticipate them getting, we now think they have about $1 million left that needs to be filled. And so that's a rough summary of our four top charities. And again, the table in the blog post we put out is the best summary of the information that I just laid out. Then we have our four standouts. You know, these are organizations that we expect to continue watching and could potentially become top tier in the future. Two of them run this program, Salt Iodization, which appears to have very strong evidence supporting the idea that when you iodize salt, you significantly improve children's cognitive development. Both of the organizations that we are recommending, they're not directly on the ground implementing these programs. They're working with governments and the salt industry to encourage them to iodize and to maintain high quality programs. And so the connection between their activities and impact has been more difficult for us to tease out. But because the program is very strong, we think the organizations have been transparent and shared information. We certainly could imagine them being on the top of our list in the future. The other standout that I want to highlight is Development Media International. I'll call them DMI. They produce mass media broadcasts that promote improved health behaviors with the aim of saving lives. And, you know, the question with DMI is whether or not those radio programs have the effect that they hope. Because if they're able to change people's behavior with mass media, then they have an incredibly cheap way to change people's behavior because they reach so many people. On the other hand, I think there is a question, a pretty serious one, whether they're effectively changing people's behavior. They're running a randomized controlled trial in which they measured moderate improvements in behavior when people self-report what they did or did not do. And they should have the final results of that trial out at some point in the next few years where they measure mortality, meaning the actual effect on children's, you know, death rates based on the areas in which they're running the program. And so we're optimistic about them and are excited to keep watching them. Now, I just want to very, very briefly touch on some of the things that we're planning to do to find new top charities in the future. So I already mentioned that we're going to keep watching some of our standouts, and I think you might see them at the top of the list in future years. One of the main things we'll be doing next year is undertaking assessments of interventions that we haven't assessed before. So I mentioned at the beginning that one of the first steps in our process is evaluating the evidence and cost effectiveness of a program. We did that this year with salt iodization. Next year, we hope to do that with additional micronutrients like folic acid and iron, additional campaigns to provide immunizations, specifically tetanus, meningitis, and measles, and then also an economic empowerment program that some of the research groups at Harvard and MIT have studied most heavily, called the Targeting the Ultra Poor program. That's another intervention that we hope to look at. And then we'll be trying to identify charities that are implementing those programs. We also have done some work, and we talked about this in our 2014 plan blog post that we put out earlier in the year, is supporting the creation of new top charities. And so what we've done there is we have, well, Good Ventures, which is a foundation we work closely with, has provided a grant to an organization called New Incentives. They provide conditional cash transfers in Nigeria, and where Give Directly gives people cash and places no condition on it, New Incentives is planning to give cash to women, to pregnant women who are HIV positive, when they complete the drug regimen that prevents mother-to-child transmission of HIV. And so this is the possibility is that you both have the benefits of cash transfers and potentially reduced HIV/AIDS infections. New Incentives is an organization that has been very transparent, though they're still very new, and we're not yet at the point where we think they could be on our top charities list. We haven't yet written very much about them, but that's something we'll be doing more of in the future. The other part of trying to support new top charities or the creation of new top charities is trying to help build the evidence base for interventions that that we would consider. There are cases where a program might have one trial that demonstrates it's effective. I think a good example of this is a program that provided incentives to families when they brought their children for immunization, rewarding them with, I think, a bag of lentils or rice. This program was extremely promising when it was conducted as part of a trial, but it's still only one trial. And so one of the things that we have thought about doing, and I think we will be doing next year, is providing some support to, some support to organizations that are trying to replicate that trial to get more information. So I'm going to pause there, and I'm going to turn it over to you all for questions. I'm going to start off with a couple questions that were emailed in before the call that touch on two of our top charities, AMF and Give Directly. Again, if you want to ask a question, feel free to type a message in the chat pane on the right side of the Uber conference window if you've logged in on your computer, or you can just email us directly at info@givewell.org. So first, a couple questions that were emailed in about AMF, which is the Against Malaria Foundation. The first question says the AMF review we don't talk very much about other malaria organizations in Malawi or the Democratic Republic of the Congo, the DRC, where AMF is now working. And so the question is, do we expect that AMF is increasing the number of malaria nets in those countries, or are they doing a better job than the, otherwise would have been done in their place at getting nets to people in those countries? I don't think there's a simple answer to this question. I think that it is definitely my intuition is that AMF is concerned with the quality of distributions at a level that is rare, and therefore it is more likely that they are at least getting higher coverage rates than would be achieved in their absence. AMF actually ran a small study that I believe we've posted on our website, though I'd have to track it down, where they followed up in districts that the government had distributed nets beforehand to see whether the coverage rates were high, and they found relatively low rates, you know, significantly lower than what they have achieved in their ongoing distributions. And so, you know, I think you can always ask questions about the quality of that study, but I think there's, you know, a reasonable case to be made that at the very least they're improving coverage rates. I also think it's not unlikely that in their absence, places like the DRC and Malawi wouldn't have nets. One of the things that I think we saw over the past few years as AMF struggled to complete distributions is that because of the requirements that they had for countries, countries were hesitant to take money for nets from AMF if they had other options, because the other options required less monitoring and were just generally easier on the country. And therefore, I think there's it's reasonable to believe that when a country is ready to work with AMF, they are, you know, in some sense, without AMF, they would have a very difficult time accessing nets. Finally, you know, there remains a relatively large global funding gap for nets. And if you go to our review of AMF on our website near the bottom of the page, we detail the, you know, the amount of nets that are still needed in the world. You know, next year in 2000, if you include 2014 and 2015, there's roughly 75 million nets that are not financed. 75 million nets to deliver them, you know, you're talking about roughly $400 million. And so, you know, even if DRC or Malawi would have had nets, I think that, you know, ultimately there aren't enough nets in the system to cover everyone who needs them. And any nets that come in end up covering more other people down the line. So I do think that, you know, ultimately AMF is accomplishing, you know, both the improved coverage goal and the, you know, and the goal of covering more people with nets. The second question that we received on AMF just says that, you know, AMF is going into the DRC. This is a place that, you know, we've said is difficult to work. You know, why do we talk about that as a moderate risk to AMF success and, you know, not say that it's a severe risk or something even more concerning about their ability to successfully implement the program? The fact is that we have, you know, relatively little information about how hard it is to work in the DRC. And so I think that it is possible that AMF will fail to, I mean, it's certainly possible that they will fail to accomplish what they want. That said, our experience with AMF is that they are particularly concerned about finding places where they are confident that nets will reach the people that are intended and they will have a successful program. And I believe it's this level of concern that partially contributed to AMF's difficulties in finalizing distributions between the beginning of 2012 and the middle of 2014. And so because of that, the intensity with which they are trying to identify distributions that they think they can succeed at, and the caution that they took in finalizing a new distribution, that, you know, to some extent gives me slightly more confidence than I otherwise would have that they'll be able to make this work. I think that it's, you know, there are possible arguments to be made that, you know, one could say, well, they waited so long and they needed to have a, you know, a deal done. You know, I think that is certainly, you know, it's certainly possible, but it's, you know, it's something that I think is, you know, is less likely. So now I'd like to turn this over and, you know, want to let people ask some of the questions that they've, you know, that they're asking. So this is a question from, I'm sorry if I'm pronouncing your name wrong, but from Rosa, and I'm going to unmute you. I think I'm going to unmute you on your computer. If that's not right, let me know, and I can unmute your phone as well. So, Rosa, you should be able to ask your question now.
It's Rosa, but thanks very much. Yeah, I think this was a question about dispensers for safe water. Was that the one you were referring to?
Yeah, sure, please.
So I was just interested whether we'd be able to get a preview of your update, which you're going to release at some point in the spring, and in particular, whether there's any new evidence on the blinded studies and whether there's any evidence on the self-reported diarrhea, because I think those were your two sticking points previously when you last did your update in, I think, last November.
Yep, that's right. So, Rosa, I just I muted you again, and if you want to ask a follow-up, just comment again in the chat window. So the question is about dispensers for safe water. This is a water chlorination program that is implemented by Evidence Action. Evidence Action is the parent organization of the Deworm the World initiative, one of our top charities. It more or less runs these two programs, Dispensers for Safe Water and the Deworm the World initiative. We evaluated the evidence for water chlorination programs last year. We have a page up on our website. And what we concluded is that the evidence that merely cleaning or improving the quality of the water was not sufficient to prevent cases of diarrhea among children. Diarrhea is one of the leading causes of child mortality in the developing world. And so, this frankly is a, the evidence is mixed, and it's quite a complicated situation about how to weigh the evidence. And so I'll leave that to you if you'd like to go back to the page. But, ultimately the conclusion we reached was that the evidence was mixed, and therefore the evidence that improving water quality prevents diarrhea and saves lives in the context of, sub-Saharan Africa was not one that we were, was not a, something that we were confident in. What we did this year, we didn't do a proactive search for additional studies of water. I believe there are some trials ongoing through what's known as the WASH benefit study, but I don't think results from that are due out for another couple of years. What we did do is we tried to assess the cost effectiveness of the Dispensers for Safe Water program with the idea that, if it were extremely cheap to clean water, then even if the evidence was relatively uncertain, we could still make a bet on it based on lower confidence of impact, but still, high cost effectiveness or high expected value of impact. When we looked at the Dispensers for Safe Water cost effectiveness, it appeared to us that, one would need to be relatively optimistic about the evidence to have a cost effectiveness figure that was, in line with our cost per life saved estimate for the Against Malaria Foundation. And so because of that, we decided to not recommend donations to Dispensers for Safe Water. I just want to throw out a few caveats to all of that. The first caveat is, again, these cost effectiveness estimates, we put the Excel files up on our website. You can walk through them if you want. They require a great deal of judgment call. And I think that, we put some weight on them, but they're certainly not the most important input into our process. In this case, we felt like it was a good way to think about whether or not we would recommend donations to this entity, Dispensers for Safe Water. Another caveat is that we have a different reading of the evidence than Dispensers for Safe Water, and a response from them is on our water quality page, where they explain their perspective that the evidence for water quality interventions is stronger than we believe it to be. The final complication with Dispensers for Safe Water is that some donors are interested in supporting it because of its carbon reducing, or at least carbon reducing on expectation nature. Basically, by cleaning water through chlorination as opposed to through boiling, that saves carbon. And there are companies that will support Dispensers for Safe Water through carbon credits. We looked a little bit at this, and we published some conversation notes on it. I think if you really believe that Evidence Action dispensers for safe water will successfully be able to get revenues from people interested in reducing carbon credits, it's possible that this could be a very cost-effective option. You know, that was something we looked into relatively briefly and didn't feel confident enough in that it would lead us to recommend them. So I want to, we had another question. This is from Matthew, and it's about the Deworm the World initiative. So let's see, Matthew, I'm going to unmute you so you can ask your question.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yep, you sound great.
Okay, so I was just wondering, the Deworm the World initiative, I was wondering if you give any like anecdotal examples of what they do, because you keep saying that it's like, or I mean, it says in the description that it's a supporting and advising role. Firstly, why isn't an organization that supports and advises the government on this actually government funded, and what do they actually do? I guess is my question.
Yep, that's a great question. So, Matthew, I'm going to mute you again, and Tim, why don't you answer this question?
Sure. So, the Deworm the World initiative works hand in hand with governments in Kenya, India, and it's looking to expand to other countries. Most of the study that we have on the website focuses on the work in India, which is sort of most representative of the work they're hoping to expand. So I'll talk mostly about their work there. They work hand in hand with state level governments in India, and the Indian government is the one that's paying for, you know, a lot of the costs associated with those deworming programs. But they but Deworm the World initiative is offering their assistance with their own funding because they believe that they can make the deworming programs better. And frankly, I don't believe that the Indian government would be willing to, you know, pay for those costs just to make those programs better. I don't have a lot of direct evidence to make that guess, but part of it is based off of other programs where the Indian government cooperates with nonprofits, and the nonprofits provide their own funding. And when there isn't a nonprofit available, the government doesn't hire a consulting group in the few examples that I've seen. It instead just, you know, runs it without a consulting group and maybe runs a worse program or doesn't have a program. But to your question about what activities they actually do, it ranges from providing, you know, conducting a prevalence survey before they start operations in a state, which allows the state and Deworm the World initiative to see what the prevalence and intensity of the worms in that area are, you know, which could change, for example, how often you would want to deworm or if you'd want to do mass deworming at all. Then helping set up a training infrastructure and provide training materials for the government to use as it trains teachers and principals and other people up, other government employees up the chain that are active to make the deworming program happen. Deworm the World also hires an independent consultant to come in and basically audit different parts of the program. And they, you know, they will go to a subset of the schools that are implementing these deworming programs and see whether they're happening and record information that indicates whether it's being successful or not. And then Deworm the World initiative also compiles some of the data and that indicates how many children were actually reached and encourages the government to sort of improve their data collection systems to make that information better and also to have an idea of how high quality that information is. That's a sort of example of a suite of things they do with the Indian states they work with. And then the other major thing that they're doing is encouraging new governments, whether it's Indian states or a new country like Indonesia, to actually take on and start a new school-based mass deworming program. And so they will contact relevant authorities within the government agency and, you know, offer their own assistance and also convey the benefits of deworming in order to encourage them to actually start a program there.
Matthew, does that answer your question? I unmuted you again. Does that answer your question? Do you have any follow-ups, or does that help get at what you were wondering about?
Yeah, I think that I think that gets at it pretty well. So, what mistakes has like the governments made that they've corrected? Like, for example, can you think of like a, I don't know, something sort of concrete that they did wrong and are now doing right?
Yeah, this is a good question. I mean, one of our biggest outstanding questions for Deworm the World Initiative that you can see on the page write-up that we have, our review of them, is how much they're improving the quality of the programs in the Indian states. You know, whether they're, you know, there's an argument that they're causing these programs to happen, they wouldn't be happening at all, or that they would be happening, but they wouldn't be as high quality. The direct evidence we have of this is not super great. But one example is one example that we have is from Bihar, where they've worked for several years. And there's a couple changes that we've seen in the Bihar deworming programs over the last few years as Deworm the World Initiative has been involved. Now, Bihar was not doing any deworming before Deworm the World, so we don't have a direct comparison to before. But even just from the changes we've seen, one thing we've noticed is that the number of schools that turn in forms that are that can be checked and verified and sort of retabulated is much higher in the most recent round of deworming than it was in earlier rounds. And this is something that Deworm the World focused on the last round to try to make sure a higher portion of the schools were turning in forms that reported their coverage, how many kids had been treated that day. And so there's an argument that that's increasing the quality of the coverage data. Another change that's been happening in Bihar, that Deworm the World Initiative hopes to happen in the next round of deworming of Bihar is that they will include preschool age children in addition to school age children in the deworming program. Treating preschool age children is a little bit trickier and ends up being left out of a lot of government-run programs. I mean, one difference is that you can't give pills to preschool age children because they might choke on the pill, and instead you use a syrup. And so, you know, regardless, Bihar has not done that in the past, but at Deworm the World Initiative's encouragement, Deworm the World Initiative thinks that they're likely to do that in the next round next year. One other fairly sort of sketchy data point is there was a report of a child in India, I believe it was in Andhra Pradesh, a few years ago, dying while choking on a deworming pill. And while I believe that to be extremely rare, that is an example of the type of thing that Deworm the World Initiative is very sensitive to and is trying hard to prevent those sort of worst case scenarios, because not only does it do the immediate damage, of like killing a person, but it also could totally backfire on the entire program and cause a shutdown due to, you know, public outcry of the entire program, or stop a new state from adopting it altogether. And so there's certainly an argument that Deworm the World Initiative and their higher level of attention and their ability to increase the amount of attention that the government itself pays on these programs because they know someone else is watching can prevent some of those worst case scenarios.
Great. So we're going to move on to some other questions. The one thing I just wanted to note about the recording and transcript, we're not planning to put the audience names in this unless you ask us to. It would just be the sort of content of your questions. So where I've said your first names on the call, and if that's something you'd like me to take out, we're totally happy to do that. So we have some questions about GiveDirectly that I want to move to now. So Taman, sorry if I pronounced your name incorrectly, but Taman, do you want to ask the question you have about GiveDirectly?
Certainly. Am I getting through? Can you hear me?
Yep, I hear you.
Excellent. And that is how my name is pronounced, yes. My question, I guess, basically boils down to, are you more confident in your... Sorry. So GiveDirectly's funding target that you've put in the post was, relative to the other charities, lower than I would have expected given the enthusiasm that GiveWell has had for it in the past, and that it seems to be the clear winner in basically everything that isn't cost effectiveness. Do you feel that your cost effectiveness analyses are more robust than has been the case in the past now, or are there other factors that I'm not seeing? Sorry.
Yeah, no, that question makes a lot of sense. It's a really good one. So let me go through what has gone into that decision. One of the big changes this year relative to previous years is that the estimated difference between the cost effectiveness of deworming and bed nets versus cash transfers has gone up. And so where in 2012, which was the first year we recommended GiveDirectly, I think we thought the difference was 1.5, that we thought bed nets and cash and deworming were 1.5 to 2 times as cost effective as cash transfers. And last year it was, you know, more in the range of 2.5 to 3.5 times. I mean, now we're looking at estimates that are between 5 and 20 times. The biggest impact for that change was a study we wrote about over the course of the year by Kevin Croak, which, you know, it significantly increased our confidence in the deworming intervention. But nonetheless, that was one major change. It was, you know, it was seeing this larger difference between the interventions. We do not feel any more confident in our cost effectiveness analysis. You know, that was actually something we wrote about in the post, that I think we did not put sufficient effort and attention to cost effectiveness early enough in the year. And so we still do have some, you know, some remaining questions. We also are going to be publishing a post, hopefully in the next couple of weeks, laying out the details of what changed in our cost effectiveness estimates more clearly. So it's a little bit easier to, you know, to understand and think about the main factors that changed. The other big factor that has changed with GiveDirectly relative to the other organizations is that a couple of years ago, we saw a possibility, a major possibility, that funds going to GiveDirectly would have some upside. And what we meant by that is that GiveDirectly was this tiny organization. It was, you know, in 2012, it, I think, moved on the order of $500,000. And so by providing it with a few million dollars, we were enabling it to reach a level of scale where it could become a bigger part of the conversation about aid, run more research experiments, and generally have more of an impact than just the impact of its programming alone. Given GiveDirectly's current size of, you know, on the order of, you know, $20 million a year, we no longer think that marginal funds to GiveDirectly have the same likelihood of having this major upside benefit beyond just getting cash to very poor people. And so that's, you know, that's something that is sort of noted in small type below that summary table I referenced earlier. But that's another consideration that has shifted how we think about GiveDirectly versus the other organizations. You know, that said, I think it is worth keeping in mind that our cost effectiveness estimates are incredibly rough. And the more skeptical one becomes of cost effectiveness analysis in general as a mechanism for deciding where to give, the more skeptical one becomes, the more one has the belief that aid in general is difficult to implement and that it requires a like high degree of you know, ability, transparency, and monitoring to do it well. I think, you know, those are the types of values or beliefs that would, you know, push someone in the direction of GiveDirectly. On the other hand, if you put a lot of weight on cost effectiveness estimate and you are, you know, more you know, more you believe that aid in general is sort of easier and more promising and monitoring is less important, I think that would push you in the direction of AMF or SCI. Does that answer your question? Any follow-ups or does that cover it?
I think that mostly covers it. One thing that I can't think of, have your release on the cost effectiveness of AMF changed or relative to cash transfers, or are those still approximately the same as was the case in previous years?
Yeah, good question. It has changed slightly. The biggest way in which it's changed is that we attribute so the main effect that deworming has, or that we weigh for deworming, are these long-term developmental impacts. And in our cost-effectiveness analysis, we believe that nets have similar developmental impacts to deworming on a per-person basis. And, you know, that comes from a couple of places. It comes from the fact that nets and deworming have similar short-term effects on conditions like anemia. So obviously nets prevent malaria and deworming clear these parasites, but they both prevent anemia. And I think that there's a reasonable case to be made that the prevention of those short-term general health problems may be one of the factor that is driving the longer-term developmental effects. There's also one of the studies that we rely on for deworming is a retrospective study on hookworm eradication in the American South in the 1920s by a researcher named Hoyt Bleakley. And he did a similar study of malaria eradication or a malaria elimination in the American South. And in both the case of deworming and malaria, he found significant long-term returns, I believe, on academic attainment and earnings after these programs were rolled out. We tend to be pretty skeptical of non-randomized controlled trials, but this was a study that, you know, we felt was particularly compelling. And so those two facts together, the impacts on short-term health from things like anemia and the Hoyt Bleakley studies finding similar effects for malaria and deworming on long-term developmental long-term developmental outcomes, let's call it, has led us to attribute some of those developmental impacts to nets as well. And so when the Kevin Croke study increased our confidence in the relationship between the short-term program and the longer-term effect, some of that also went over to our bed net calculation and has also improved the case for bed nets. So I know that's sort of a long answer, that is what I believe is going on in our cost effectiveness estimate and also contributed to nets improving this year. So Damon, I'm going to mute you again. If you have any other questions, just send them through. And just a reminder to anyone else who is interested, you can email questions to info@givewell.org and we'll answer them on the call, or, you know, you can ask us to unmute you if you give us your phone number. And then you can ask yourself. You can also, you know, chat them through on that chat window. We had a couple other questions sent in about GiveDirectly where the person just asked us to read them ourselves. So we said that GiveDirectly expects to receive about $10 million from non-GiveWell influence sources in the near future. And the question was, like, how certain is that? How likely are they to receive significantly more or significantly less? Is there any likelihood that they would receive close to their max of $40 million, or what we have characterized as their maximum amount? We don't have great resolution on this to be able to answer it well. I mean, GiveDirectly has tried to do this. They shared a document with us a few months ago in which they thought, you know, their range of funding would be between $6 and $18 million. I actually don't know whether or not that included GiveWell influence funding, and that, you know, that number is now out of date, so I don't think you should rely on it too heavily. I think the bottom line is that they have a relatively good chance of getting the $10 million. I think, you know, just based on how our experience and talking to them, they're unlikely to hit that $40 million, and I don't think I can give a more precise estimate of how likely they are to receive different amounts of funding. Another question about GiveDirectly that we got was, you know, how, let's say that, you know, GiveDirectly received near the higher end of its gap. So, you know, right now we're targeting GiveDirectly to receive around $16 million. That means it'll relatively stay at the same size that it is. You know, what would happen if GiveDirectly received $30 million or $35 million? Would that increase its capacity, or, you know, would it start to run in sort of speed up its process of growth? You know, in general, do we think, how big do we think GiveDirectly can become, and what's their path for becoming, you know, significantly larger? You know, I don't see any inflection points for GiveDirectly now. I mean, and I don't know what GiveDirectly staff would say about this. So it's, you know, it's a good question for them. And I think they're holding a conference call on Friday. And if, you know, anyone is looking for information on, you know, for the public, if anyone's looking for information on that, you can probably find it on their website or email me, and I'm happy to, you know, track it down and send it to you. You know, I think that I don't see inflection points in their growth. I mean, I think my understanding is that their aim is to become, you know, go from being a $20 million organization to a $100 million organization, you know, over the next 5 to 10 years, and that they recognize that that's going to require a significant amount of fundraising from the retail donor market. That will be a big shift from them, in that GiveWell-influenced donations have been a sizable portion of their funding throughout their history. You know, GiveWell-influenced and other institutions like Google.org, which gave them a substantial grant. And so, you know, our view is that we don't see the inflection point, and that the main obstacle to GiveDirectly growing as large as they want to be is finding the funding sources that will support them as they grow. And, you know, our best guess about who that is that it's the, you know, the retail donor market, you know, everyone giving their, you know, $1,000, $500, $5,000, you know, as opposed to getting the money from institutions. And, you know, I think that'll be a challenge for them to try to meet, but, you know, one that we're, you know, certainly hopeful that they can pull off. So I'm going to go through a couple more of the questions that came in. And, you know, also just, again, feel free to send in any questions if you have them. I think we're getting close to wrapping up based on the questions that have come in so far. Someone asked a question about Living Goods, which was the final standout organization that I didn't mention in my initial remarks. Living Goods is a standout organization because they have conducted a randomized controlled trial of their program. What Living Goods does is they support, manage, and direct a group of what they call micro-entrepreneurs, which are individuals who buy health goods and other household goods from Living Goods at wholesale prices, and then go door-to-door and sell them to individuals living in Uganda. And in their randomized controlled trial, they found a 27% reduction in childhood mortality in the areas served by Living Goods, as opposed to the ones that were the control group, those randomly selected to not be served by the Living Goods program. 27% is a very large result, and so it's one that, you know, I think is really exciting. You know, the study that was conducted for this RCT is not yet fully public, and so we, you know, haven't been able to sort of get into all the details of the study and weigh the strengths and weaknesses. I mean, we've seen a draft, but haven't been able to discuss that all publicly, and that's one of the things that, you know, we're hoping to do in the coming year, to sort of get into, as we do with all the research we consider, you know, all the strengths and weaknesses and alternative hypotheses for the program. Yeah, so that's Living Good. I want to go back to, so now I'm going to move on to some other questions. This is going to go back to Rosa. You had some other questions about donations and donation coordination. So why don't I unmute you so you can ask your question.
Yeah, thanks very much. I guess the question was, I'm not 100% sure whether it was answered in the blog by Holden yesterday because I haven't read it yet. But the question was, I mean, a lot of your write-up was about donors coordinating and your target amounts for each charity. I was wondering if you've looked into setting up a donor advised fund. So if people are willing to just say, right, we're going to give money to GiveWell's recommended charities and we trust GiveWell to divvy it up in the most effective way, and then basically trust you to handle that. So I guess, yeah, have you looked into it and is it possible to do?
Yeah, great question. I mean, we definitely could set up a mechanism for donors to give and have us allocate the funds. I think it's possible that that's where we'll end up long term, that that becomes the default option. You know, right now donors can give to us and we'll regrant them to our recommended charities based on the allocation that we laid out in that post. The reason we have not pushed this option harder is that in our experience, you know, donors have pretty strong differences of opinion about which charities they want to support. And that while some of them, you know, some donors, you know, pretty much agree with our judgments, you know, these judgments are based on values that not even all the donors who, you know, follow GiveWell's research share. And therefore, donors want, you know, often want to have the decision themselves about whether their funds support the debate that has been most salient over the last few years with our recommendations, whether they support an organization that does deworming like SCI or cash transfers like GiveDirectly. And so in our experience, the donor preference has been strong enough that we've continued to make that the default option for most donors. But if, you know, there was a lot of interest in this, and certainly if people wanted to kind of bring up ways that we could make this work for everyone better, you know, we'd be happy to do it and to consider it. We got two other questions that sort of related to funding for charities. So we said in the blog post that we anticipate about, you know, roughly $7.5 million going from individuals to our top charities over the next 4 months, like through giving season in early 2015. What we didn't talk about was what part of that we would think would go to the standouts. You know, that so the standouts, meaning the two salt iodization organizations, ICCIDD and GAIN-USI, and then also DMI and Living Goods. I think we have far less information about how much money will go to those standouts. And that's because we haven't had standouts on our website since 2011. When we did, you could look and see on our website, on the impact page of our website, how much money went to them then. My recollection, it was on the order of, you know, tens of thousands of dollars each. That said, GiveWell was significantly smaller then. I think the standouts that we have today are significantly stronger all around as in terms of giving opportunities than the standouts we had in 2011. And so I think it's plausible that these organizations will receive significant amounts of money, especially if donors do some of what I was saying before and you know, decide that, you know, they think the evidence for salt iodization is stronger than we do, or they are less, you know, they're less dependent on seeing a track record of the organizations that are implementing the program, or they think that Development Media International or Living Goods programs are sufficiently cost-effective to be worth supporting. So I think it's quite hard to predict. Good Ventures, the foundation we work closely with, made grants of $250,000 to each of the standouts, in addition to a $100,000 grant that came from Good Ventures to each of them for their participation in our process. And so, you know, even if donors give no more, each of these organizations will have received $350,000 this year for their participation with GiveWell and, you know, the overall, you know, quality of their work. And we hope that that becomes, you know, something of an incentive to others to participate in our process and, you know, do the type of monitoring and evaluation and transparency that, you know, all eight of the organizations we have on our page now are undertaking. The other question about funding was, you know, when we expect to update our recommendations based on funding received. And just, this is the last question I have to answer. So if you've been holding out till the end to send your question in, now is the time to do so, because the call is coming to a close. Our plan is we're aiming to publish an update on funding situations and therefore recommendations on April 1st. That is, you know, 4 months from now. We expect the bulk of the funding that we influence to come through by the first week in January. But, you know, it takes some time for all the checks to arrive and for us to process the donations out the door to the charities and then for them to plan. And so we think that April 1st is around the time that we'll have been able to, they'll have the money, they'll have been able to plan, we'll have been able to follow up on it, we'll have been able to then think about what that means for their funding situations and update our recommendations to reflect the new situation. I'm going to turn it over to Taman again. He had another follow-up question about GiveDirectly.
Thank you. You mentioned that GiveDirectly, one of the major reasons you recommended it as highly as you did in 2012 was because of the potential for upside. And also, in a subsequent question, that now they're at a $20 million organization, they need to find sources of funding that will bring them to $100 million. Is the reason you think there was more upside than there is now because donations in 2012 helped them get from half a million to 20 million, but it's more difficult for just give well-influenced donations to get from 20 million to 100 million? Or is there something else?
Yeah, so let me try to explain this and as I see it, and let me know if it's helpful. I mean, I think that the funding that GiveDirectly received between 2011 and 12 and last year was funding that took them from what I would characterize as very small, somewhat unknown startup organization to, you know, established, well-known, credible nonprofit. And I think that difference is significant in terms of GiveDirectly's ability to be taken seriously in the aid community, to potentially raise money from less sophisticated or less informed donors, and to, you know, go through the process that they had to go through to build out the operational capacity to move, the types of money they moved last year. When I first visited GiveDirectly in Kenya in November of 2012, I mean, the total staff size was so small that, you know, just having one or two, you know, really strong individuals on staff could have enabled them to move $1 million a year. And, you know, I think that part of what the money that came in enabled them to do was go through the process of building out that operational capacity. You know, I could imagine someone saying, and this could be the case, that, you know, the jump from 20 million to 50 million or something is just as significant an operational hurdle to overcome. My intuition is that it's not, but it, you know, it certainly could be the case. And if you believe that, I think that you could continue to make that upside argument. But I certainly think, like, back at the time, there was this question of whether GiveDirectly would even continue to exist 2 years later. And, you know, providing that funding to them back then and over the last couple of years brought them up to a level of, a strong foundation with a level of, strength in their existence that I think they're much more, they're in a much better position to continue, you know, to continue going into the future. Another question just came in over email. So the question relates to room for more funding and how we think about, you know, whether, you know, the question is basically, you know, we've talked about the Do You Earn the World initiative having $1.3 million in room for more funding, or SCI having $6.8 million in room for more funding. You know, what does that mean, I think, is the question. You know, don't we anticipate them just, you know, it seems like one of the worst cases is they would just hold the money for a future year, and then that money would have, you know, utility in that next year as well. And so is it really, what does it mean to say that their funding is capped? I think that, you know, so with the money that we're talking about for these organizations, in many cases, so in certainly in SCI's case, and this is detailed in the review, a good deal of this funding will be held in reserve for future years. And reserves are important. I mean, GiveWell, we're a nonprofit, we hold reserves. because it's hard to plan your work if it's possible that 12 months from now, you know, you would need to drop everything and try to fundraise or you know, potentially have to lay off staff or something. So we do try to take that into account. You know, that said, I think there comes a point where an organization has a sufficient amount of funding in reserve that it seems as if the funding would have a greater impact if it went to the other organization. And, you know, that is, you know, roughly speaking, the numbers we put in the post, you know, for Deworm the World and SCI are, you know, close to 2-year numbers in that they include both funding they would spend this year and funding that they anticipate spending in the following year based on, you know, holding it back. And then, you know, the situation, you know, sort of differs by each organization. You know, that said, I think if you look at any of these organizations and say, you know, I feel extremely confident that this organization sort of stands far above the others in terms of how they would use money and what impact it would have, I don't think it's unreasonable to give them more money, which is essentially giving them, you know, more resiliency and flexibility for the future. So in our view, you know, based on the differences we see between the organizations, as we hit the cap for one, you know, we start wanting to shift funds over to another, or I should say by the cap, I mean the cap that, you know, we see for each of them. But I think the caps are certainly very debatable. And I don't think it would be unreasonable for people who had access to the same information that we have to see different caps for all of the organizations that we, you know, that we've recommended. So, that covers all the questions that I, you know about right now. If, you know, again, if you're interested in asking something, you know, you still have a second to either chat on the Uber conference window or send us an email. But if I don't see that, I just wanted to say, you know, thank you so much for your interest in GiveWell, for your willingness to spend some time on a phone call talking about the nitty gritty details of some charities. You know, I know there's a lot of ways that people do charitable giving, and we really appreciate the active, thoughtful engagement of the donors who use our research, because it, you know, not only is, frankly, fun to talk to you all about the research that we do and think through these questions, but your questions help us do our job better. It holds us accountable, and it, you know, makes sure that it brings up things that we might not have thought of to go back and answer in future years. So thank you so much. I really appreciate it. If you have any questions that come up that you didn't think to ask right now, please feel free to email them in after the fact. We're always happy to hear from you. Have a great night.